This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Neil Diamond, started out writing songs for a music publishing company in the hopes that someone would record them. He wrote the Monkees' number one hit, I'm a Believer. But it was Diamond himself who made most of his own songs famous. Songs like Solitary Man, Cherry Cherry, Girl You'll Be a Woman Soon, and Sweet Caroline. As a lot of his contemporaries fell off the charts, he moved from teen pop to adult pop. He recorded a duet with Barbra Streisand, had hits from his remake of The Jazz Singer, and dressed in spangles for his sold-out concerts. Now he has a new CD that is intentionally unglitzy. It's an album of new songs produced by Rick Rubin, who recorded Johnny Cash's musically and emotionally naked final albums. Before we hear from Diamond, here's a track from his new CD, 12 songs. Brian Wilson makes a special appearance doing the harmonies.
Pretty soon we were taking it serious, me and you underneath a mysterious spell. Nothing I could do, and it suddenly felt like a bolt out of hell. I'm telling you, to the sound of the beat I was hanging on, like a powerful truth it was banging on me. Wouldn't let me go, like a shot in the dark. She was hot like a spark. I only know neither one of us trying to hold it down, neither one of us taking the middle ground. Wasn't how to make sense we were thinking of, just the two of us bent on delirious love. Me and you being spent on delirious love, like a ride on a rocket it took us up.
That's Neil Diamond from his new CD, 12 Songs. Neil Diamond, welcome to Fresh Air. How did
you
and
much.
Rick Rubin get together and decide to collaborate on this new CD?
Well, you know, Rick is a highly regarded presence in the music business, and I've always been curious about him, but I never thought that I'd work with him. It seemed that he was more into heavier rock. He did a number of rap records, and just more recently did the Johnny Cash anthology, and I didn't see where I fit into that. But we met, we finally connected up, we met, we talked, and I realized we weren't as far apart as I thought we might be, and that he had a pretty good beat on what he wanted from an album with me. But there was no telling, you know, write this kind of stuff or write that kind of stuff. It was just write the best you can, and let's listen to it and see if I can see a record in there.
But I imagine he wanted the instrumentation more stripped down.
Well, yes, the instrumentation was bare and sparse and stripped down. That's something he did want after we worked together for a while. It became clear to him, I think, that this would be a very basic, cut to the bone album of my songs.
Neil Diamond, when you're writing for yourself, as you've gotten older, do you write a different kind of song? I mean, you started writing songs when you were a teenager, and that was in the 60s. So do you think that the songs you write have changed as you've gotten older and experienced more, and you're not a teenager?
Yeah, I have to say that they have changed, certainly from the beginning, because the early songs were all teenage laments and, you know, meant for that age group somehow, because that was the audience at that time for a single artist, and especially a guy with a guitar. But over the years, you grow up, you mature, you see things in a different way, and it's reflected in the writing. So, I mean, at this point, my writing is different. I think it's better. I think it's deeper. But it's, strangely enough, it covers a lot of the old ground. Maybe it says it in a better way, a more sophisticated way, but it's that old thing. You know, I write a lot about relationships, and I did that at the beginning, too. Maybe immature and kind of rough around the edges when I first started, but they're basically the same subject over the last years.
I think it's fair to say your first big break, correct me if I'm wrong, was when you had recorded a demo, and the songwriters Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry heard the demo and they really liked you. And they, some of their songs are Do Run Run, Chapel of Love.
Be My Baby.
Be My Baby, yeah. So how did they hear you?
I was making a demo. Usually when you sold a song to a publisher, they would allow you to go in and make your own demo, which was an invaluable experience to me. But I went and made the demo and hired Ellie as a backup singer, which she did, despite the fact that she was having huge hits. She liked to sing in the studios with the other girls, and so I hired her for this session, and she liked something about what I was doing, my writing or my singing, and she brought me to her husband, Jeff, and he liked something about what I was doing. I don't know if he liked the writing or the singing, but one liked one, and the other one liked the other, so we started a working relationship. We were both working for the same music publisher, and I kind of got let go by that music publisher, and I asked Jeff and Ellie if they were interested in producing me.
In the first session that you did with them, you recorded Solitary Man. Did you like the idea of horns on this?
I like the idea of anything on those records. I was just thrilled to be there.
Well, let's hear Solitary Man, which I have to say, I think it's really a terrific recording.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, okay, let's hear it. This is your first hit, yes?
Yes,
you recorded yourself.
Hit.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Neil Diamond, Solitary Man.
The Linda was mine till the time that I found her. Holding Jim, loving him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong. That's what I thought, me and Sue. But that I do. Don't know that I will, but until I can find me a girl to stay and won't play games behind me, and I'll be what I am, a solitary man, solitary man. I've had a
Neil Diamond. Now, did you write this song for yourself or for somebody else?
No, I wrote this for myself. I had a contract with Jeff and Ellie, and I started to focus in on just what I wanted to do. And so Solitary Man was written for me and for the first sessions that I was to do with Jeff and Ellie.
There's this like urgency in the song and in the way you sing it, and I think of you in a way as kind of specializing in some of your work in that urgency. Some of the music on your new CD, 12 songs too, has that just really urgent sound to it. Is that something you've been conscious of that you think really like works especially well for you as a songwriter and as a singer?
Well, I can tell you that I wasn't conscious of it until you just mentioned it. I've never thought of my songs having that sense of urgency, but I'll listen again and maybe as an objective observer you can pick up on that stuff, but I never felt that there was an urgency, a sense of drama, a sense of yearning, lots of things, but not urgency. But you may be very right about this. I'm going to listen again now.
So how did Solitary Man change your idea of what you wanted from your musical life?
Once I had a chart record of my own, I was no longer a kid knocking around on the streets. I was now, we didn't call them artists at that time. We called them vocalists, but I was a vocalist. And it was a whole different thing. I was writing for myself, so I had to really dig in and write as well as I possibly could, And I have to say, before that time, I don't know if I was doing that. I was just writing and writing and writing, maybe just to get an advance from a publisher. But there was not a lot of me in those songs. And Solitary Man was the first of a long line of me songs, my experience songs.
When you were working in the Rock and Roll Tin Pan Alley, were you actually, and you were writing for music publishers, were you actually going to an office building every day to write?
When I was signed to a staff publishing company, a music company, I would go in as often as I possibly could. The subway train from Brighton Beach, where I lived, that took us to New York University, went also a few more stops further to Tin Pan Alley. So there was a lot of cutting of classes, going up and trying to peddle the newest song, probably that I had written in one of the classes at school. And so it was an attraction. It was a seduction that was just a couple of stops beyond NYU. And I unfortunately spent a lot of time skipping that the NYU 8th Street stop and going up to the 49th Street stop, which is where Tin Pan Alley was. And that was great fun, too.
Now, were these several buildings? Was it just the Brill Building or 1620 Broadway also?
Well, 1650 Broadway.
1650, yeah, sorry, yeah.
That's all right. Yes, the Brill Building, but there were dozens and maybe hundreds of other music publishing companies in that area in all kinds of buildings. It was that era when rock and roll had just come in, and anybody could get a listening to their music because the publishers didn't understand what rock and roll was, and they were willing to listen to anybody and sign anybody that they thought might have the vaguest chance of having some success. So it was an open game for a number of years. But then things got serious. I got married. I was having a baby on the way, and I had to get serious. Enough with this fun.
When you were working as a songwriter for publishers, writing for other people, were you writing for specific people? Were you writing with specific singers in mind?
Well, that's usually how it went back then, although I was never a good enough writer to kind of write for some other singer to understand what they did best, the keys, the kind of song. Usually you were told that so-and-so is coming up for a session in 3 weeks and they need a song of this type, and it was usually as close as possible to the song that they had previously, which was a hit, if it was a hit. And you had to write a kind of like a copy of that in a way, because that's the way it worked in those days. You have a hit record, and your next record should sound as much like the hit record as you can make it. But I wasn't very good at it. That's probably why I spent 8 years down there in Tin Pan Alley and had very little success. Nothing more really than selling a song and taking a small advance for it to get me through the week.
Now, the Monkees did a couple of your songs, I'm a Believer and A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. Did you write those with them in mind or for yourself? I'm trying to think of what the chronology was. Like you start recording in, what, like 67?
66.
66, okay. And what year are the Monkees? Like, is that after that?
I think 67, something like that. I had recorded a couple of songs, including Solitary Man and Jerry Jerry, which was a big hit. And because of that hit, the people who were producing the Monkees called and said, we like Cherry Cherry, do you have any other songs? I said, well, I don't have anything like Cherry Cherry, but I have an album coming out soon, and I'll send it over and take your pick.
You know, it's funny, the common wisdom goes when telling the story of, like, songwriters from the Brill Building and the Beatles, is that the Beatles changed everything. After the Beatles, bands started writing their own songs. It drove out the professional songwriters. But, of course, the Monkees are a band that's, you know, a kind of fabricated band copying the Beatles. and you have this tremendous success writing for them. And in that sense, like, the Beatles' success inadvertently really helped you as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. But it was not only in the sense of the Monkees doing a couple of songs. It was in the sense that the doors began to open for songwriters who were able to sing. And I just happened to be one of them who'd been knocking around the streets for years and now suddenly was getting a new and fresh listening to my work. So the Beatles made an enormous change, and as did Bob Dylan. They brought the songwriter up to the front of the line and said, you know, you guys do it. And it had a devastating effect on the music publishing business in Tin Pan Alley. But it opened up many doors for people like me.
My guest is Neil Diamond. Here's his version of I'm a Believer.
I thought love was only true in fairy tale, meant for someone else but not for me. Love was out to get me. Pointing on good all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. And I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried.
One of the things you've done is, you start in you start in the movie, the jazz singer, and it was a kind of updated, new interpretation of the Al Jolson movie,
right?
And in this movie, you're a rock singer, but your father's a cantor, and he wants you to lead the more traditional life and to sing the more traditional material, and you're of course doing neither. And he acts as if he's in mourning, and he's completely lost his son. And of course, you wrote all the songs for it too. Now, in your father wasn't a cantor, but he did, from what I understand, listen to a lot of Yiddish recordings. Did he listen to cantorial records as well?
No, never any cantorial music. He listened to, he did lip sync for charities around Brooklyn, and he listened to operatic records, including Yiddish records, and he did lip sync and mime to those records. But there was always music playing in his shop. The radio was always on, so I became pretty familiar with all the top 40 records. They danced. My parents were very big ballroom dancers, so that music was around. They got into Latin music for a while, so that music was around, and I learned to dance that way. A lot of it ran off from my parents to me until I was able to start my own little thing. I bumped into folk music when I was about 15, that made me want to get a guitar. And so at the beginning, I played only folk music, the folk music that you play at camp around the fireplace. And it developed from there.
My theory is that the music that you hear when you're young imprints itself in your mind and forms like your basic vocabulary of musical sounds and of melody and harmony. So do you think that music affected your own songwriting eventually?
I think it did. I think it had some influence on the kind of songs I wrote and maybe even the melodies, because the melodies of some of those early Yiddish things are so strong that they do imprint on your brain. But I must say that more than that, my experiences at camp and playing the guitar and wanting to play folk music and wanting to meet the girls had a much stronger influence on my decisions to go ahead and make this my life's work.
So what were the songs you sang at camp?
Well, we sang all of Woody Guthrie's songs. We sang a lot of the Weavers. Not so much Hank Williams. I think I got into Hank Williams a little bit later. But it was mostly the folk songs of that period, Pete Seeger. That type of music was what I kind of started with.
I want to ask you about another of your songs, and this is also an earlier song. It's Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, and the Urge Overkill version of this was used by Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. Can you tell us the story behind the song?
Oh, behind the song was pretty basic. I was playing mostly to teenagers, teenage girls, when I first started. Going through that period, I just wrote a song for the audience to do, for me to do in the show, and for the audience, which was, as I say, teenage girls. And Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon was something I wrote for them, and I recorded it myself.
How did you find out that Quentin Tarantino was going to use a version of this song for Pulp Fiction?
Well, first they have to request the right to use it. There's no general license for that. Each one has to be requested and negotiated and either agreed or not agreed on. But I got a request and a part of a script to be used in this movie called Pulp Fiction. And I've always held to a very tenuous line as to what I wanted my songs to be used as, and I wouldn't let them be used in cigarette commercials or alcohol commercials. And the script that I read was way out there. It was beyond what I would turn down normally, and I did turn it down. I heard almost immediately from my publisher, who said, you know, you shouldn't turn this down. This guy's a tremendous director, and you should just do it and let them do it, which I did. And, of course, I've never regretted it, because it was an entirely different way of seeing that song. But that's basically how it happened.
So what'd you think of the movie?
Oh, I loved the movie. I was amazed by the movie. I've seen it.
How come you loved the movie but didn't love the script? What was different actually seeing it?
Well, I didn't get the whole script. I only got a few pages of the script in which the song would be used. And I don't know if you remember the scene, but she was, Uma Thurman was very heavily into a coke binge, and she went unconscious and had to be taken for some quote-unquote special treatment. It just seemed too strong for my own taste, and I turned it down on that basis.
Well, here's a song you wrote to please your teenage fans, and now it's going to be used in an overdose scene, in a drug overdose scene. Not what you had in mind.
Not at all, but I would have reacted the same to any of the other songs I had written.
Mm-hmm. But it was very effective in the film.
It was very effective, and it was a lesson that I learned, you know. See who else is working on it. See how serious they are. Don't take it at face value, and don't take your prejudices into this kind of discussion.
Well, why don't we hear your version of the song? Here it is.
Great.
Girl, you'll be a woman soon. Love so much, can't count all the ways I'd die for you, girl, and all they can say is, isn't that your kind? They never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around. But I'm gonna find, don't let them make up your mind. Don't you know, girl, you'll be a woman soon. Please come take my hand. Girl,
the That's Neil Diamond, one of his earlier hits, and he has a new CD called 12 Songs. One of the things that has kept you musically successful over the decades is your tours. Would you describe a little bit how you put together your idea of what a show should be?
It's a good question. I've never worked with a director. I like to put the shows together myself with the help of a lot of other people, including the band, my band, who've been with me for many years. And we start right at the beginning. I have a huge blackboard in the studio, and we start with the songs that I want to include and that we haven't included in previous shows. I try to find a good opening song, a good closing song, which is usually, traditionally for me, has been Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show, because it kind of sums up what I'm about and what I'd like the world to be about. And you fill in and you try to make something interesting, and each song has to have something that's new and fresh and original about it, even if it was written 30 years ago.
What about figuring out what to wear for your shows?
I never thought about it. I have a clothing designer. His name is Bill Whitten. He's been doing my stage clothes for 35 years now. And so I let Bill take the lead in that. I have comments, obviously, things I like and don't like. But Bill handles that, and I think he decided in the mid-70s that he wanted to go with glass beading and sparkly kind of things, basically, I think, because no one else was using it, and it would become mine. So, okay, I tried it, and I think it worked very well, although it's become a point of contention. I mean, just the fact that you bring it up is what has been happening over the years. I'll get a review for a show, and they'll think the show is wonderful, but they'll put down the shirt, which is terrific. I'd rather have them put down the shirt than something important. But I've been wearing those kind of shirts, and now it's tapering off now. But the shirts have been part of my persona on stage for as long as I can remember.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote and recorded, a big hit for you, Sweet Caroline, which is now played at Red Sox games at Fenway Park, and maybe you know the story of why of why that is. But let's start with the song itself. Is there a story behind the writing of the song?
Yeah, I think so. I was heading down to Memphis for my first recording session down there, and there were some producers I wanted to work with, and I only had two songs written, and in those days a session was 3 hours, and you usually had three songs that you recorded. So the night before the session at some motel in Memphis, I knocked out this song, Sweet Caroline. It was one of the fastest songs I've ever written, and we recorded it the next day, and it became one of my biggest songs, if not the biggest song. But songs usually don't come like that. There's usually a lot of work and teeth gnashing and agony and torment over any of these songs. But that one just popped out, and there it was, and here it is now. Still, people can sing it.
It's also sung a lot in bars.
Well, the fact is that it's fun and easy to sing with, and I think that that's the bottom line as far as that song is concerned. It's easy to sing. It's fun. People like to sing it. And that's why it's popular in bars, because anybody can sing it, no matter how many drinks you've had.
Well, Neil Diamond, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.